Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're back downtown. We're at Lexington Market. And I'll tell you what, I'm hungry. I came very, very hungry. Don Moley, this might be the worst place on earth to come hungry when you have a microphone and you can't eat. We have it about an hour. It's going to be a great hour, maybe a little longer if we can keep David Harbeck. But I'm going to eat today. I'm getting a crab cake today.
That's not a real surprise to our listeners. They now understand that on Thursdays at Baltimore Positive, you come with an appetite, whether we're at State Fair in Catonsville, whether we're at Jennings, we're at Fadley's.
I've been doing radio 30 years.
You come with an appetite.
I try to get early, eat, and get ready. Today, I didn't do that because it's crab cake. I wasn't going to eat a crab cake at like 10 in the morning, right? So,
and you're going for the big jumbo lump crab cake.
I'm all in today. I'm 1,000,000% in. So we have educators here today.
Wait, but before you get to Dr. Hornbeck, last thing.
Go ahead.
I did check, and Dr. Hornbeck may not know as well. As our listeners know and those who watch on Facebook, about a month ago, Nestor got a lesson on how to eat a steamed crab. He thought as an East Side boy, he knew how to eat. Well, the owner of Fadley's took him to school, Damie Hahn, and she showed him how to eat.
Right where you're sitting. Literally, right where you were sitting.
And Nestor demonstrated it on the air. I checked today. For some unfathomable reason, it has now been viewed 1.8 million times.
Since July 2nd.
There's education at work.
So we're going for 2 million. Hop on Facebook, Nestor, Crab Video, help us get to 2 million. Although I do want to say, I don't think I've seen Nestor try to replicate that technique
yet. I haven't been back yet. No. Today might be the day. I cut my finger last time and all of that. So the education part of my crab video was simple. Damie showed me once. I did it. Don has been educating me since the first day we met at Dundalk High School in August of 1982.
Wow.
When my marching orders did not allow me to have Journalism 1 as my elective in 10th grade. And my parents marched me down to Dundalk and said, Don Moeller, I need in Don Liefert's class for journalism.
Fix this.
My son's going to work for the New York Times. He's going to be John Stedman. So the education part began with him, 37 years ago now, and here we are.
And here we are
and
today.
And you went to the top. Where were you in August of 1982? You were probably doing something really wonderful with people.
I had been, by that time, 6 years, the Maryland State Superintendent of Schools. And I have to tell you one crab story about me in that way.
Before you do, Dr. David Hornbeck, legendary Maryland educator, really national educator. Just a thrill to welcome Dr. David Hornbeck to Baltimore Positive. Now, your crab story.
There you go.
It's great to be here.
It's good to have you.
In 1976, I came here from Pennsylvania. I didn't know how to eat crab. I had never had a hard-shelled crab.
Right.
And the State Board of Education, a week after they selected me, one of the guys found that out. And he said, I have to make a motion to the rest of the board that we rescind our offer to David. Anybody who hasn't grown up, and boy, did I learn how to eat hard-shelled crab.
Did you end up enjoying them?
Oh, I did. I must say that your reference to crab cake, though, I like it better, frankly, when it's put together for me.
Oh, come on, man. It sounds like a guy from out of town. I can't hire you. You can't run my school
system. A little less work. Well, right. It is a real honor to have you here. We with Baltimore Positive, we're trying to put a focus on things that will make Baltimore better. And when Nestor and I were talking, education's always at the forefront. And not to flatter you because you're sitting here with us today at Fadley's, I think it would be hard in the nation to find someone who has spent decades battling, and I think that's the right word in your case, battling.
79 was the big battle, right? So we're 40
equity.
Years out on your big battle. Can I, right. just for my audience and for the, tell us in 45 seconds the background of where you're from and how, what led to that, the beginning of all of this, because, I mean, it's a fascinating journey reading up on you, and I don't know how to sort of put it all into 30 seconds.
How did somebody who was going to be a minister and then ended up in law school and not an educator, per se, become one of the most renowned educators? How does a minister attorney become the top education advocate in the nation.
Not the normal route to doing some of these things, but my first job out of seminary was as part of the campus ministry at Temple University, and they had no money to pay me, so I had to work at something, and I ran a tutorial project in 25 low-income communities around the city, and I learned during that period of time that education needed to be my ministry, that in fact that was more gospel-based.
That's the most important thing you could do with your life.
Most important thing I could do with my life. And then
how old were you then? And you had already committed on another path, right?
I was 25.
So the first journey led you to the second journey.
Exactly.
Perfect.
And I went to law school.
That's a third journey. Hold on. How many journeys?
Well, my mother-in-law used to say, you've been to seminary and you didn't become a preacher. You've been to law school. You didn't become a lawyer.
What are you going
to
do with your life?
What are you going to do with your life? Why did my daughter marry you? And I didn't have a really good answer.
And you've been married for many, many moons.
56 years.
There you go.
Oh, that's all in a minute.
There you go. There you go.
Yep. She's the best.
So you make this decision to go into education because you feel like that was the best way for you to serve the earth, right?
Exactly.
Never a day of regret in that, right?
Not for a moment. My only regret is that now, a half century later, we are largely fighting the same battles that we were fighting when I first went into education. You could sort of say, when I was in seminary, I worked in East Harlem for 2 years. And so, in a sense, that's when I started. But beginning with jobs, it's 53 years this year, and the battles are largely the same and getting worse.
David, that's what I was struck by. And that's why we rarely go in a linear direction on Baltimore Positive. But today, I think we will, because I think there's some benefit to it. Because I was struck by what you just said. I went back to the beginning of your career. You know, you're the Maryland State Superintendent in 1976.
Right.
Three terms, I think, a long time
12
to be
years.
A State Superintendent. I mean, a pretty darn impressive track record. So you're there in the beginning of what I'm going to, and correct me if any of this is wrong, but my recollection is you're there on the ground floor of high-stakes testing. Project Basic. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, and we did it differently in Maryland. Most places focused only on reading or reading and math. We focused on reading, math, science, and what we called citizenship, because we thought that all kids ought to be engaged in the community, trying to make it a better community, being engaged in small p political activities and so on. And
what era is this? 70s?
This would have I first introduced it in 78.
And as an example, I'm in fifth grade at the time, so I'm a Baltimore County student.
There
I'm a student under your watch and learning about dinosaurs in third grade and learning about India and Africa in fifth grade and social studies and, you know, all the things that I think Don was a social studies teacher before I knew him, and this is our civics course together.
So great example, Nestor. So you're in the fifth grade. You're being directly affected.
He's trying to mold my
life. The changes that Dr. Hornbeck's
trying to bring. So I would understand the Constitution when Donald Trump's running the country.
Sure.
I would understand the Bill of Rights. I would understand these basic citizenships, how we treat each other as human beings, as citizens.
Yep. That's exactly right.
So walk us back again, if you can. Let's go behind the curtain a little bit. If we take us into the boardroom, when you're trying to have discussions early on about introducing some kind of common test that will allow us to measure student achievement, and then also take us into the public discussion. Because I think when you go back almost 50 years, people would be surprised to hear what we were talking about back then.
Well, the idea at that time, historically, education had been based sort of on seat time. If you kept your nose clean, you behaved yourself, you stayed in your seat for 12 years, you graduated and you moved ahead. And what we were trying to do was to shift that to having it matter more at the end of the day. Can you read? Can you do math? Do you know the Constitution? Do you know these things?
Can you be a functioning citizen?
A functioning citizen. That's exactly right. And the board was pretty responsive to me and those ideas. And there was a guy who was head of the state board at the time named Dick Shifter, who was a fantastic public servant in the state, and a guy who later became the deputy director of the Peace Corps was the vice president of my board, a guy named Bill Sykes. And they understood this stuff. And so they were very supportive, and they were very interested in altering the way in which education was practiced in the state, so much so that they gave me a period of time before I officially took the reins to travel around the state for a period of months. And the day I took office, I presented to the state board a full fleshed out plan of moving ahead. Frankly, many of the things in it are things that today the Kerwin Commission is about to, well, it has recommended. For example, I recommended full-day 4-year-old pre-kindergarten programs at the time. Now, if I go outside of the boardroom, the board was very supportive of that. If I go outside of the boardroom, I find people around Maryland who think that that for 4-year-olds is encroaching on the role of the family, and they push back against it in really important ways. So
my son was born in 1984, and when he was 4 years old, 1988, I don't know what the rules are now, but 30 years ago, the only way he could be in pre-K was to be remedial in some way.
That's right.
Right? So we had to pay. We wanted to get him ready. I sent him to a daycare over in Eastwood and paid whatever, $15, $20, whatever day it was, so that he could get training wheels to be ready for kindergarten.
He's
a relatively well-functioning human being at 35. It's been a little while, but that's still 30 years later. We're still having that problem.
If I had
a 4-year-old child right now, I'd take him to Colgate Elementary, which doesn't exist right now on my side. But if I do that, then there is an issue.
No, excuse me.
We're doing a show. We'd love to answer your questions.
We'll answer you when we take a break. Thank you.
No worries. In regard to an elementary school and being able to go and put my child in 2019, that wouldn't be the case right now?
In Baltimore City, it would. Baltimore City had the foresight a couple of years ago, out of its own money, it's not state money, Kerwin would change this. They introduced a 4-year-old pre-kindergarten, but that's only happened in the last 2 or 3 years, despite the fact, blow your mind, 80% of a kid's brain has developed by the time he's 3 years old, 90% developed by the time he's 4 years old, and policy in Maryland doesn't start school until the kid's five.
Right. So that disconnect has been there now again.
Long time.
We're going to do an entire episode later in the show on Kerwin. So I want to come back again. So you're traveling the state. You're talking to the board. I mean, this is a major, we don't think of it today as a major revolutionary idea. There's certainly spirited discussion still about how much testing. It seems to me the discussion today is how much versus, you know, do
whether.
We do too much or whatever, but not a discussion about whether or not we need some kind of testing. It's accepted. That wasn't accepted back then.
Another example, the first time we did the math test around the state, only, I don't remember what it was, but only 40% of the kids were able to pass it. Members of the General Assembly got calls from lots of their constituents. They called me to Annapolis to say, what are you doing in this instance? And what I did was to take the test to Annapolis and pass it around among the members of the General Assembly sitting at the table. And I said, tell me which thing you don't want your kid to be able to do. And by the time the test got around, they understood that the objective was to create the conditions in which all kids could do these
things.
Well,
it's so interesting, Dr. Hornbeck. We had Dr. Nancy Grasmick on a few weeks ago, and we asked her the very straightforward question. We said, we know there still are opponents to some form of high-stakes testing. But we said, how can I measure that a student in one school versus a student in another school is getting the same education without some kind of metric? And she looked at both of us and said, you can't. She said, just straightforward. She said, you can't. And that's been the issue. But
I don't like can't as a word. No. Why can't you?
Because without that kind of measurement, there's no way. I use the example, and Dr. Hornbeck has seen it many, many times. You know, I was a middle school principal. I was a high school principal. The bottom line is, and I had my children all went through the public school system. So someone, you're teaching Algebra 1 in Classroom 101. Someone else is teaching Algebra 1 in Classroom 103. Your students get A's and B's. The one in 103 gets A's and B's. That A doesn't tell me a thing because I don't know how you grade. I don't know what your standards are. We need some kind of common measure. I'm looking to the expert here.
Exactly.
Well, I'm a kid that took the Iowa test, you know, back in 1975 or whatever, standardized testing. And I remember that being kind of controversial then. You know, I mean, and certainly across, you know, social lines and what kinds of questions and what's a fair question to ask an 8-year-old kid of what they should or shouldn't know about social situations, let alone just, you know, find a math question, something that had a true answer.
Well, those are important questions in testing, and we've gotten better and better at it. We haven't solved all the problems, but one of the factors that's involved in testing, the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, for example, in my judgment, was a bad test.
Fair enough. So you didn't even like it, and you were administering it to me.
There you go.
Okay, fair enough.
Let me finish as to why it was a bad test.
Fair enough. But no wonder I did so well.
If you fill in the bubble with a number 2 pencil, you really don't have to think. There's no problem solving involved in that. And because you end up guessing along the way. And so it doesn't, again, really measure. And
wasn't that higher level skill?
It wasn't a higher level skill.
Pick 1 of 5 is not really a life. You know, oftentimes things are the 6th or 7th or 8th option, right?
And when we got to Project Basic, and then even more when we got to what Nancy did, which she, Nancy Grasmick, she built the system even better. You began to have to write your answers. You had to think about them. You had to do paragraphs. And now it's even moved beyond that, where you begin to take account of actually, in a sense, doing your answer, where you do projects.
And she's as passionate about it today as you remain.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, because Dr. Grasmick acknowledged, why has the concept of testing, and it got tied up in Common Core, why does something that appears to be so straightforward and truly so American, per se, I mean, common sense, we ought to know how well our children are doing if we're going to spend these, why has it become so political?
Well, I think it's because, for example, as you put it a little while ago, there's too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the Kerwin Commission recommendations is that you improve the testing and you reduce the number of times people get tested. But in some school districts, kids will spend 6 weeks before the test learning to take the test. If the test is not a good test, then learning how to do what's not a good test is counterproductive, and you lose 6 weeks of instruction time. In contrast, the kind of thing that the Kerwin Commission is recommending is you change the test so the actual act of test preparation, if you want to call it that, is the same as learning things. For example, in class, your homework would consist not of rote pieces of paper, but of writing things overnight. And that's not a test, but when you get to the test and that's what you have to do, then you're more prepared for it.
You make me smile. Nestor, funny story, Dr. Hornbeck will know this, but there's an educational expert and leader named Madeline Hunter. And I can remember someone quoting Madeline Hunter one day, going to what you're talking about, rote memory. And she was saying that a young person said to her one day, if I've got to do these multiplication tables, this worksheet tonight for my homework. And after I do 10 and show you that I can do 10, why do I have to do 90 more? And Madeline Hunter said, because whoever gave you that's an idiot. I mean, you know, and that's what you're saying. Not picking on that particular teacher, but the idea that it's about mastery, and once we do it, let's push and go on
and all
to
of
something
this,
else, right?
All of this has become more and more important as the character of the economy has changed and the nature of qualifications.
Yeah, what are you capable of doing? I employ people. I mean, right. I honestly say, I've done sports radio. I mean, journalism and all that. 25 years, I have not had a ton of really, really qualified kids. Luke Jones notwithstanding,
right.
Peter DeLutis.
Right.
But, you know, I've known Don my whole life. I would always say, I can't believe journalism students send me resumes, not just with typos, with just right. fundamental
grammatical errors.
Well, it's like the President of the United States not knowing what a proper noun is
yeah.
on a daily basis and
yeah.
saying he's Ivy League educated.
Yeah.
To me, that's offensive to a guy who knew that in the fifth grade.
Never mind whether the idea is any good or not.
Just the sheer... Well, and maybe this is some snobbery of mine. And look, Colgate Elementary, Hollabird Middle, Dundalk High, Dundalk Community College, University of Baltimore, okay? I was not Gilman to Dartmouth to grad school. That was not my pathway. But I have known how to conjugate verbs, complete sentences. And you know what the damnedest thing is? Spell check.
Yeah.
Spell check fixes
right.
it all. It's kind of like a calculator. Calculators are $100 when I was in, or my family would have bought me one. Mm. I would have cheated and never known how to do math instead of having to learn how to do it, right? I would think that it's so easy to get it right that when you get it wrong, it's just sheer laziness.
Yeah.
Like just, I don't know where else it is, but
well,
there is a laziness in learning that I think that has to start in the home and start in the beginning. And I know we'll get to all that. I just had a real quick question. If we're not testing people, how does anyone ever get a law degree? How does anyone ever get a medical? What in real life, there is that bar to entry to say I'm qualified or not.
You have to pass the MCATs. You have to pass the LSAT.
Well, I have one job. Someone's going to get
right.
it. What is that bar? And that bar is a test of some kind, right? I mean, for better or worse,
that's the
right?
battle that Dr. Hornbeck's been having, again, for decades. Before we take our first break, I was struck because I think it's so true today. As when you started this battle in the 70s, one of the things that I saw you quoted on many years ago was you said, one of the things that makes education reform so difficult is that the majority of Americans, when you ask them to rate their child's school, they give it an A or a B. They're
right.
very happy with their child's school. The other thing is that the majority of Americans think that their elementary school education or their high school was excellent. The way it was. So why, if it was good enough for me,
right?
In 1978, right.
am I quoting you accurately?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, it's a real difficulty, a real challenge when you're trying to take account of a changing economy, a changing quality of life, all the changes that to change education from something that was good enough for you or good enough for my kids. Kind
got
of
us
thing.
To the moon back in 69, right? I mean, seriously, right? I mean, hey, saved my wife's life with medicine at Hopkins twice, right? You know,
why
we've done okay in this generation.
Well, and the
you
other
know?
Really important thing in this is the fact that things that worked for people a long time ago even then didn't work for everybody. And kids who were poor, disabled kids, minority kids, language minority kids, did not have the kinds of opportunities that worked for people.
Well,
and so we kind of limit ourselves sometimes when we're thinking about what worked to that middle class, somewhat more not well-to-do, but regular old kid and the experience that kid had.
And if it didn't work, it's interesting, and this is a great place maybe to take our first break. Nestor's an East Side guy. So we talked both with Dr. Grasmick and recently with County Executive Reshevsky. What people forget, and you're alluding to it right there, is that back in the 50s, 60s, probably even early 70s, if you lived on the East Side, and you dropped out of school, it wasn't a big deal.
Right.
You went right to General Motors. You went right to
Bethlehem Steel. You were employable.
You were employable with a good family supporting job. So it was like, okay, I dropped out of Dundalk High, but I'm going right to the point. I'm going right to General Motors. As the economy evolved from that industrialized model, those jobs weren't there.
And that's not just Dundalk. There's a Dundalk everywhere. That's a Dundalk everywhere, right?
Well, I'll give you two examples making this point. One is that if you don't graduate high school, you make $20,000 less a year than if you do graduate high school.
Wow.
That's one. Second is, which just blew my mind when I heard this, and we've got to take account of this, an African-American man without a high school diploma lives 14 years shorter life than a white man with a college degree. So
it's a health issue as
well. It is a health issue. It is a housing issue. It is an employment issue.
It's a society issue.
Crime. I mean, a study was done by the legislature a few years ago, and they ascribed, I think the number was $600 million the previous year, having been spent in Maryland prisons to educate 12,000 high school dropouts.
Wow.
So maybe we don't save half of that by having only 6,000, but we save several hundred million dollars in that process. And that's the kind of negative way of thinking about it. The positive way is that then you have 6,000 more people productively engaged in work that is meaningful for them, generating money. Going back to early childhood and the four-year-old thing, D.C. Required a four-year-old pre-kindergarten two or three or four years ago. They just did a study recently, and they found that of the kids in four-year-old pre-K at that time, that there was a 12% increase in the number of those kids' mothers who worked. So if you translate, let's say those people were paid, I don't know what, $40,000 a year even. If you think of the well-being of those mothers, those families, just because the kids even had a place to go when
breakfast and they have dinner and they have a roof over their heads, right?
Huge differences as a consequence of what Kerwin has recommended.
What a great place, I think, to stop.
Absolutely.
And again, when we come back,
let's go to the streets of Philadelphia.
I do like the streets of Philadelphia. Also, there have been a few lawsuits along the way with Dr. Hornbeck.
Yeah, I read up on that.
We're going to talk, and they've all been related to equity. So Baltimore Positive.
You want to change the world, you're going to make somebody angry.
That's true.
It's true, right?
I think Dr. Hornbeck has found that out.
Well, just one story on that. When I went to Philly, I guess it was when I went to Philly, not here, tried to buy a house. The realtor came back after checking my credit. It was in Philly because the lawsuits were here in Maryland. They came back and said, the record says that you have, I don't know what it was, 75 lawsuits against you. And what's going on? And I said, well,
I thought you were a theologian and an educator.
That's the name of the game if you're a superintendent of schools.
Bob DuBell used to say every time that letter would arrive at his home, his wife would have a heart attack. He'd say, that's okay, I'm the superintendent.
We have people
Dr.
for that.
David Hornbeck.
Don Moeller, Dr. David Hornbeck. We're here at Fadley's in Lexington Market. We got to get two more quick segments. I don't want them to be quick. See, it's a problem because I'm in a hurry to eat the food and it makes the conversation short.
We knew there would be a lot of smart conversation today about education when you have Dr. David Hornbeck.
Learning stuff, eating crab cakes. We are WNST.net, AM 1570 at WNST, Towson and Baltimore Positive. We're back for more right after this.